We now continue with the encyclical on faith and religion of Pope Pius IX. We hope that our political leaders will keep in mind, in accordance with their piety and religion, that the kingly power has been conferred on them not only for ruling the world, but especially for the protection of the Church. Sometimes we act both for the sake of their rule and safety, that they may possess their provinces by peaceful right. We hope that with their aid and authority they will support the objects, plans, and pursuits which we have in common, and that they will also defend the liberty and safety of the Church, so that the right hand of Christ may also defend their rule. We hope that all these matters may turn out well and happily. Let us together entreat God in urgent and unceasing prayers to make up for our weakness by an abundance of every heavenly grace, to overwhelm with His all-powerful strength those who attack us, and to increase everywhere faith, piety, devotion, and peace. Then, when all enemies and errors have been overcome, His Holy Church may enjoy the tranquility it so greatly desires. Then, too, there may be one fold and one shepherd. That the Lord may more readily respond to us, let us call as intercessor her who is always with Him, the Most Holy Virgin Mary, Immaculate Mother of God. She is the most sweet mother of us all. She is our mediatrix, advocate, firmest hope, and greatest source of confidence. Furthermore, her patronage with God is strongest and most efficacious. Let us invoke, too, the Prince of the Apostles, to whom Christ Himself gave the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whom He made the rock of His Church, against which the gates of hell will never prevail. Let us also invoke His fellow apostle Paul and all the heavenly saints who are already crowned and hold the palm of victory. We ask that they implore for all Christians the abundance of divine favor which they desire. Finally, as an augury of all the heavenly gifts and as witness of our great charity towards you, receive the apostolic blessing which from deep in our heart we most lovingly impart to yourselves, venerable brothers, and to all clerics and the faithful laity who are entrusted to your care. Given in Rome at St. Mary Major's on the 9th of November, 1846, in the first year of our pontificate. The Encyclical of Pope Pius IX on Faith and Religion. The Syllabus of Errors Condemned by Pius IX. Note well, the following teachings, as stated, are condemned as errors. Pantheism, naturalism, and absolute rationalism. There exists no supreme, all-wise, all-provident divine being distinct from the universe, and God is identical with the nature of things, and is therefore subject to changes. In effect, God is produced in man and in the world, and all things are God and have the very substance of God, and God is one and the same thing with the world, and therefore spirit with matter, necessity with liberty, good with evil, justice with injustice. All action of God upon man and the world is to be denied. Human reason, without any reference whatsoever to God, is the sole arbiter of truth and falsehood, and of good and evil. It is law to itself, and suffices by its natural force to secure the welfare of men and of nations. All the truths of religion proceed from the innate strength of human reason. Hence reason is the ultimate standard by which man can and ought to arrive at the knowledge of all truths of every kind. Divine revelation is imperfect, and therefore subject to a continual and indefinite progress, corresponding with the advancement of human reason. The faith of Christ is in opposition to human reason, and divine revelation not only is not useful, but is even hurtful to the perfection of man. The prophecies and miracles set forth and recorded in the sacred scriptures are the fiction of poets, and the mysteries of the Christian faith the result of philosophical investigations. In the books of the Old and New Testament, there are contained mythical inventions, and Jesus Christ is himself a myth. Moderate rationalism. As human reason is placed on a level with religion itself, so theological must be treated in the same manner as philosophical sciences. All the dogmas of the Christian religion are indiscriminately the object of natural science or philosophy, and human reason, enlightened solely in a historical way, is able by its own natural strength and principles to attain to the true science of even the most abstruse dogmas, provided only that such dogmas be proposed to reason itself as its object. As the philosopher is one thing and philosophy another, so it is the right and duty of the philosopher to subject himself to the authority which he shall have proved to be true. But philosophy neither can nor ought to submit to any such authority. The Church not only ought never to pass judgment on philosophy, but ought to tolerate the errors of philosophy, leaving it to correct itself. The decrees of the Apostolic See and of the Roman congregations impede the true progress of science. The method and principles by which the old scholastic doctors cultivated theology are no longer suitable to the demands of our times and to the progress of the sciences. Philosophy is to be treated without taking any account of supernatural revelation. Indifferentism and latitudinarianism. Every man is free to embrace and profess that religion which, guided by the light of reason, he shall consider true. Man may, in the observance of any religion whatever, find the way of eternal salvation and arrive at eternal salvation. Good hope, at least, is to be entertained of the eternal salvation of all those who are not at all in the true Church of Christ. Protestantism is nothing more than another form of the same true Christian religion, in which form it is given to please God equally as in the Catholic Church. Socialism, communism, secret societies, biblical societies, clerical-liberal societies. Pests of this kind are frequently reprobated in the severest terms in the encyclical Qui Pluribus, encyclical Nocitis et Nobiscum Singulari Quadum. Errors concerning the Church and her rights. The Church is not a true and perfect society, entirely free, nor is she endowed with proper and perpetual rights of her own, conferred upon her by her divine founder. But it appertains to the civil power to define what are the rights of the Church and the limits within which she may exercise those rights. The ecclesiastical power ought not to exercise its authority without the permission and assent of the civil government. The Church has not the power of defining dogmatically that the religion of the Catholic Church is the only true religion. The obligation by which Catholic teachers and authors are strictly bound is confined to those things only which are proposed to universal belief as dogmas of faith by the infallible judgment of the Church. Roman pontiffs and ecumenical councils have wandered outside the limits of their powers, have usurped the rights of princes, and have even erred in defining matters of faith and morals. The Church has not the power of using force, nor has she any temporal power, direct or indirect. Besides the power inherent in the episcopate, other temporal power has been attributed to it by the civil authority, granted either explicitly or tacitly, which on that account is revocable by the civil authority whenever it thinks fit. The Church has no innate and legitimate right of acquiring and possessing property. The sacred ministers of the Church and the Roman Pontiff are to be absolutely excluded from every charge and dominion over temporal affairs. It is not lawful for bishops to publish even letters apostolic without the permission of the government. Favors granted by the Roman Pontiff ought to be considered null unless they've been sought for through the civil government. The immunity of the Church and of ecclesiastical persons derived its origin from civil law. The ecclesiastical forum or tribunal for the temporal causes, whether civil or criminal, of clerics ought by all means to be abolished, even without consulting and against the protest of the Holy See. The personal immunity by which clerics are exonerated from military conscription and service in the army may be abolished without violation either of natural right or equity. Its abolition is called for by civil progress, especially in a society framed on the model of a liberal government. It does not appertain exclusively to the power of ecclesiastical jurisdiction by right, proper, and innate to direct the teaching of theological questions. The teaching of those who compare the sovereign pontiff to a prince free and acting in the universal church is a doctrine which prevailed in the Middle Ages. There is nothing to prevent the decree of a general council or the act of all peoples from transferring the supreme pontificate from the bishop and city of Rome to another bishop and another city. The definition of a national council does not admit of any subsequent discussion, and the civil authority can assume this principle as the basis of its acts. National churches, withdrawn from the authority of the Roman pontiff and altogether separated, can be established. The Roman pontiffs have, by their too arbitrary conduct, contributed to the division of the church into Eastern and Western. Errors about civil society considered both in itself and in its relation to the church. The state, as being the origin and source of all rights, is endowed with a certain right not circumscribed by any limits. The teaching of the Catholic Church is hostile to the well-being and interests of society. The civil government, even when in the hands of an infidel sovereign, has a right to an indirect negative power over religious affairs. It therefore possesses not only the right called that of ex sequitur, but also that of appeal, called appellatio ab abuso. In the case of conflicting laws enacted by the two powers, the civil law prevails. The secular dower has authority to rescind, declare, and render null solemn conventions, commonly called concordats, entered into with the Apostolic See, regarding the use of rights appertaining to ecclesiastical immunity, without the consent of the Apostolic See, and even in spite of its protest. The civil authority may interfere in matters relating to religion, morality, and spiritual government. Hence, it can pass judgment on the instructions issued for the guidance of consciences conformably with their mission by the pastors of the Church. Further, it has the right to make enactments regarding the administration of the divine sacraments and the dispositions necessary for receiving them. The entire government of public schools in which the youth of a Christian state is educated, except to a certain extent in the case of episcopal seminaries, may and ought to appertain to the civil power, and belong to it so far as no other authority whatsoever shall be recognized as having any right to interfere in the discipline of the schools, the arrangement of the studies, the conferring of degrees, in the choice or approval of the teachers. Moreover, even in ecclesiastical seminaries, the method of studies to be adopted is subject to the civil authority. The best theory of civil society requires that popular schools open to children of every class of the people and generally all public institutes intended for instruction in letters and philosophical sciences, and for carrying on the education of youth, should be freed from all ecclesiastical authority, control, and interference, and should be fully subjected to the civil and political power at the pleasure of the rulers, and according to the standard of the prevalent opinions of the age. Catholics may approve of the system of educating youth unconnected with Catholic faith and the power of the Church, and which regards the knowledge of merely natural things, and only, or at least primarily, the ends of earthly social life. The civil power may prevent the prelates of the Church and the faithful from communicating freely and mutually with the Roman Pontiff. Lay authority possesses of itself the right of presenting bishops, and may require of them to undertake the administration of the diocese before they receive canonical institution and the letters apostolic from the Holy See. And further, the lay government has the right of deposing bishops from their pastoral functions, and is not bound to obey the Roman Pontiff in those things which relate to the institution of bishoprics and the appointment of bishops. Government can, by its own right, alter the age prescribed by the Church for the religious profession of women and men, and may require of all religious orders to admit no person to take solemn vows without its permission. The laws enacted for the protection of religious orders and regarding their rights and duties ought to be abolished. Nay, more, civil government may lend its assistance to all who desire to renounce the obligation which they have undertaken of a religious life and to break their vows. Government may also suppress the said religious orders, as likewise collegiate churches and simple benefices, even those of advowson, and subject their property and revenues to the administration and pleasure of the civil power. Kings and princes are not only exempt from the jurisdiction of the Church, but are superior to the Church in deciding questions of jurisdiction. The Church ought to be separated from the state, and the state from the Church. Errors concerning natural and Christian ethics. Moral laws do not stand in need of the divine sanction, and it is not at all necessary that human laws should be made conformable to the laws of nature and receive their power of binding from God. The science of philosophical things and morals, and also civil laws, may and ought to keep aloof from divine and ecclesiastical authority. No other forces are to be recognized except those which reside in matter, and all the rectitude and excellence of morality ought to be placed in the accumulation and increase of riches by every possible means, and the gratification of pleasure. Right consists in the material fact. All human duties are an empty word, and all human facts have the force of right. Authority is nothing else but numbers and the sum total of material forces. The injustice of an act, when successful, inflicts no injury on the sanctity of right. The principle of non-intervention, as it is called, ought to be proclaimed and observed. It is lawful to refuse obedience to legitimate princes, and even to rebel against them. The violation of any solemn oath, as well as any wicked and flagitious action repugnant to the eternal law, is not only but blamable, but is altogether lawful and worthy of the highest praise when done through love of country. The doctrine that Christ has raised marriage to the dignity of a sacrament cannot be at all tolerated. The sacrament of marriage is only a something accessory to the contract and separate from it, and the sacrament itself consists in the nuptial benediction alone. By the law of nature, the marriage tie is not indissoluble, and in many cases divorce, properly so called, may be decreed by the civil authority. the Church has not the power of establishing derelict impediments of marriage, but such a power belongs to the civil authority by which existing impediments are to be removed. In the Dark Ages, the Church began to establish derelict impediments not by her own right, but by using a power borrowed from the state. The canons of the Council of Trent, which anathematized those who dared to deny to the Church the right of establishing derelict impediments, either are not dogmatic or must be understood as referring to such borrowed power. The form of solemnizing marriage prescribed by the Council of Trent under pain of nullity does not bind in cases where the civil law lays down another form and declares that when this new form is used, the marriage shall be valid. Boniface VIII was the first who declared that the vow of chastity taken at ordination renders marriage void. In force of a merely civil contract, there may exist between Christians a real marriage, and it is false to say either that the marriage contract between Christians is always a sacrament, or that there is no contract if the sacrament be excluded. Matrimonial causes and espousals belong by their nature to civil tribunals. Errors regarding the civil power of the sovereign pontiff. The children of the Christian and Catholic Church are divided amongst themselves about the compatibility of the temporal with the spiritual power. The abolition of the temporal power of which the Apostolic See is possessed would contribute in the greatest degree to the liberty and prosperity of the Church. Errors having reference to modern liberalism. In the present day, it is no longer expedient that the Catholic religion should be held as the only religion of the state, to the exclusion of all other forms of worship. Hence, it has been wisely decided by law in some Catholic countries that persons coming to reside therein shall enjoy the public exercise of their own peculiar worship. Moreover, it is false that the civil liberty of every form of worship and the full power given to all of overtly and publicly manifesting any opinions whatsoever and thoughts conduce more easily to corrupt the morals and minds of the people and to propagate the pest of indifferentism. The Roman pontiff can and ought to reconcile himself and come to terms with progress, liberalism, and modern civilization. The faith teaches us, and human reason demonstrates, that a double order of things exists, and that we must therefore distinguish between the two earthly powers, the one of natural origin, which provides for secular affairs and the tranquility of human society, the other of supernatural origin, which presides over the city of God, that is to say, the Church of Christ, which has been divinely instituted for the sake of souls and of eternal salvation. The duties of this twofold power are most wisely ordered in such a way that to God is given what is God's, and because of God to Caesar what is Caesar's, who is great because he is smaller than heaven. Certainly the Church has never disobeyed this divine command, the Church which always and everywhere instructs the faithful to show the respect which they should inviolably have for the supreme authority and its secular rights. Venerable brethren, you see clearly enough how sad and full of perils is the condition of Catholics in the regions of Europe which we have mentioned. Nor are things any better or circumstances calmer in America, where some regions are so hostile to Catholics that their governments seem to deny by their actions the Catholic faith they claim to profess. In fact, there for the last few years, a ferocious war on the Church, its institutions, and the rights of the Apostolic See have been raging. Venerable brothers, it is surprising that in our time such a great war is being waged against the Catholic Church. But anyone who knows the nature, desires, and intentions of the sects, whether they be called Masonic or bear another name, and compares them with the nature, the systems, and the vastness of the obstacles by which the church has been assailed almost everywhere, cannot doubt that the present misfortune must mainly be imputed to the frauds and machinations of these sects. It is from them that the synagogue of Satan, which gathers its troops against the Church of Christ, takes its strength. In the past, our predecessors, vigilant even from the beginning in Israel, had already denounced them to the kings and the nations, and had condemned them time and time again, and even we have not failed in this duty. If those who would have been able to avert such a deadly scourge had only had more faith in the supreme pastors of the church. But this scourge, winding through sinuous caverns, deceiving many with astute frauds, finally has arrived at the point where it comes forth impetuously from its hiding places and triumphs as a powerful master. Since the throng of its propagandists has grown enormously, these wicked groups think that they have already become masters of the world and that they have almost reached their pre-established goal. Having sometimes obtained what they desired, and that is power, in several countries, they boldly turn the help of powers and authorities which they have secured to trying to submit the Church of God to the most cruel servitude, to undermine the foundations on which it rests, to contaminate its splendid qualities, and moreover, to strike it with frequent blows, to shake it, to overthrow it, and if possible, to make it disappear completely from the earth. Things being thus, venerable brothers, make every effort to defend the faithful which are entrusted to you against the insidious contagion of these sects, and save from perdition those who unfortunately have inscribed themselves in such sects. Make known and attack those who, whether suffering from or planning deception, are not afraid to affirm that these shady congregations aim only at the profit of society, at progress, and mutual benefit. Explain to them often and impress deeply on their souls the papal constitutions on this subject, and teach them that the Masonic associations are anathematized by them not only in Europe, but also in America, and wherever they may be in the whole world. To the archbishops and bishops of Prussia, concerning the situation of the Catholic Church faced with persecution by that government. But although they, the bishops, resisting persecutions, should be praised rather than pitied, the scorn of episcopal dignity, the violation of the liberty and rights of the Church, the ill treatment which does not only oppress those dioceses, but also the others of the Kingdom of Prussia, demand that we, owing to the apostolic office with which God has entrusted us, in spite of our insufficient merit, protest against laws which have produced such great evils, and make one fear even greater ones. And as far as we are able to do so with the sacred authority of divine law, we vindicate for the Church the freedom which has been trodden underfoot with sacrilegious violence. That is why, by this letter, we intend to do our duty by announcing openly to all those whom this matter concerns, and to the whole Catholic world, that these laws are null and void, because they are absolutely contrary to the divine constitution of the Church. In fact, with respect to matters which concern the holy ministry, our Lord did not put the mighty of this century in charge, but Saint Peter, whom he entrusted not only with feeding his sheep, but also the goats. Therefore, no power in the world, however great it may be, can deprive of the pastoral office those whom the Holy Ghost has made bishops in order to feed the Church of God. Thus we conclude the syllabus of errors condemned by Pius IX. Ferrari Voss on Liberalism and Religious Indifferentism. Encyclical of Pope Gregory XVI, August 15, 1832. To all patriarchs, primates, archbishops, and bishops of the Catholic world, venerable brothers, greetings and apostolic benediction. We think that you wonder why, from the time of our assuming the pontificate, we have not yet sent a letter to you as is customary, and as our benevolence for you demanded. We wanted very much to address you by that voice by which we have been commanded, in the person of Blessed Peter, to strengthen the brethren. You know what storms of evil and toil, at the beginning of our pontificate, drove us suddenly into the depths of the sea. If the right hand of God had not given us strength, we would have drowned as a result of the terrible conspiracy of impious men. The mind recoils from renewing this by enumerating so many dangers. Instead, we bless the Father of Consolation, who, having overthrown all enemies, snatched us from the present danger. When he had calmed this violent storm, he gave us relief from fear. At once we decided to advise you on healing the wounds of Israel, but the mountain of concerns we needed to address in order to restore public order delayed us. In the meantime, we were again delayed because of the insolent and factious men who endeavored to raise the standard of treason. Eventually, we had to use our God-given authority to restrain the great obstinacy of these men with the rod. Before we did, their unbridled rage seemed to grow from continued impunity and our considerable indulgence. For these reasons, our duties have been heavy. But when we had assumed our pontificate according to the custom and institution of our predecessors, and when all delays had been laid aside, we hastened to you. So we now present the letter and testimony of our good will toward you on this happy day, the feast of the Assumption of the Virgin. Since she has been our patron and savior amid so many great calamities, we ask her assistance in writing to you and her counsels for the flock of Christ. We come to you grieving and sorrowful because we know that you are concerned for the faith in these difficult times. Now is truly the time in which the powers of darkness winnow the elect like wheat. The earth mourns and fades away, and the earth is infected by the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, they have changed the ordinances, they have broken the everlasting covenant. We speak of the things which you see with your own eyes, which we both bemoan. Depravity exalts, science is impudent, liberty dissolute, the holiness of the sacred is despised, the majesty of divine worship is not only disapproved by evil men, but defiled and held up to ridicule. Hence, sound doctrine is perverted, and errors of all kinds spread boldly. The laws of the sacred, the rites, institutions, and discipline, none are safe from the audacity of those speaking evil. Our Roman See is harassed violently, and the bonds of unity are daily loosened and severed. The divine authority of the Church is opposed, and her rights shorn off. She is subjected to human reason, and with the greatest injustice, exposed to the hatred of the people, and reduced to vile servitude. The obedience due bishops is denied, and their rights are trampled underfoot. Furthermore, academies and schools resound with new, monstrous opinions, which openly attack the Catholic faith. This horrible and nefarious war is openly and even publicly waged. Thus, by institutions and by the example of teachers, the minds of the youth are corrupted, and a tremendous blow is dealt to religion, and the perversion of morals is spread. So the restraints of religion are thrown off, by which alone kingdoms stand. We see the destruction of public order, the fall of principalities, and the overturning of all legitimate power approaching. Indeed, this great mass of calamities had its inception in the heretical societies and sects in which all that is sacrilegious, infamous, and blasphemous has gathered as bilge water in a ship's hold, a congealed mass of all filth. These and many other serious things, which at present would take too long to list, but which you know well, cause our intense grief. It is not enough for us to deplore these innumerable evils unless we strive to uproot them. We take refuge in your faith and call upon your concern for the salvation of the Catholic flock. Your singular prudence and diligent spirit give us courage and console us, afflicted as we are with so many trials. We must raise our voice and attempt all things, lest a wild boar from the woods should destroy the vineyard, or wolves kill the flock. It is our duty to lead the flock only to the food which is healthful. In these evil and dangerous times, the shepherds must never neglect their duty. They must never be so overcome by fear that they abandon the sheep. Let them never neglect the flock and become sluggish from idleness and apathy. Therefore, united in spirit, let us promote our common cause, or more truly, the cause of God. Let our vigilance be one and our effort united against the common enemies. Indeed, you will accomplish this perfectly if, as the duty of your office demands, you attend to yourselves and to doctrine and meditate on these words. The universal church is affected by any and every novelty, and the admonition of Pope Agatho, nothing of the things appointed ought to be diminished, nothing changed, nothing added, but they must be preserved both as regards expression and meaning. Therefore, may the unity which is built upon the See of Peter as on a sure foundation stand firm. May it be for all a wall and a security, a safe port, and a treasury of countless blessings. To check the audacity of those who attempt to infringe upon the rights of this holy see, or to sever the union of the churches with the See of Peter, instill in your people a zealous confidence in the papacy and sincere veneration for it. As Saint Cyprian wrote, "He who abandons the See of Peter on which the church was founded falsely believes himself to be a part of the church." In this you must labor and diligently take care that the faith may be preserved amidst this great conspiracy of impious men who attempt to tear it down and destroy it. May all remember the judgment concerning sound doctrine with which the people are to be instructed. Remember also that the government and administration of the whole church rest with the Roman Pontiff, to whom, in the words of the Fathers of the Council of Florence, the full power of nourishing, ruling, and governing the universal church was given by Christ the Lord. It is the duty of individual bishops to cling to the See of Peter faithfully, to guard the faith piously and religiously, and to feed their flock. It behooves priests to be subject to the bishops, whom they are to look upon as the parents of their souls, as Jerome admonishes. Nor may the priests ever forget that they are forbidden by ancient canons to undertake ministry and to assume the tasks of teaching and preaching without the permission of their bishop, to whom the people have been entrusted. An accounting for the souls of the people will be demanded from the bishop. Finally, let them understand that all those who struggle against this established order disturb the position of the church. Furthermore, the discipline sanctioned by the church must never be rejected or be branded as contrary to certain principles of natural law. It must never be called crippled or imperfect or subject to civil authority. In this discipline, the administration of sacred rites, standards of morality, and the reckoning of the rights of the church and her ministers are embraced. To use the words of the Fathers of Trent, it is certain that the church was instructed by Jesus Christ and his apostles, and that all truth was daily taught it by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Therefore, it is obviously absurd and injurious to propose a certain restoration and regeneration for her as though necessary for her safety and growth, as if she could be considered subject to defect or obscuration or other misfortune. Indeed, these authors of novelties consider that a foundation may be laid of a new human institution, and what Cyprian detested may come to pass, that what was a divine thing may become a human church. Let those who devise such plans be aware that according to the testimony of Saint Leo, the right to grant dispensation from the canons is given only to the Roman Pontiff. He alone, and no private person, can decide anything about the rules of the Church Fathers. As St. Gelasius writes, it is the papal responsibility to keep the canonical decrees in their place and to evaluate the precepts of previous popes so that when the times demand relaxation in order to rejuvenate the churches, they may be adjusted after diligent consideration. Now, however, we want you to rally to combat the abominable conspiracy against clerical celibacy. This conspiracy spreads daily and is promoted by profligate philosophers, some even from the clerical order. They have forgotten their person and office and have been carried away by the enticements of pleasure. They've even dared to make repeated public demands to the princes for the abolition of that most holy discipline. But it is disgusting to dwell on these evil attempts at length. Rather, we ask that you strive with all your might to justify and to defend the law of clerical celibacy as prescribed by the sacred canons against which the arrows of the lascivious are directed from every side. We will continue with this encyclical on side B of this tape.